Let's imagine that blackfellas reasserted our sovereignty, that we reclaimed our country and exerted full self-determination. What would that look like? What would our future hold? Dr. Michaela Saunders gives you a glimpse in their collection of stories, Always Will Be. Winner of the 2022 David Yonayapan Award, their book speculates on what Tweed Heads would be if it honoured Koori ways of doing and knowing. Always Will Be isn't cynical about the future. It's entertaining and hopeful. It's also deeply thoughtful and really challenges expectations of what First Nations futurism and speculative fiction can or even should be. I asked Michaela about this approach to speculative fiction, but first they read a passage from Firebug, one of the stories featured in the collection.
Every weekend from then on, Tyson worked with the Rangers. He learnt all about the science of fire by going onto country with them. He learnt the different ways of using fire and the right types to use to burn off at particular times. He learnt all about this powerful tool he was obsessed with, its potential for destruction and for renewal, and how to wield it with foresight and restraint. At first, he only watched and listened, and in this way, he also learnt patience and how to try to understand things without butting in and asking questions. On school holidays, he camped with the Rangers, and each night they all sat around the fire and yarned. They were responsible for teaching him not just about how to use fire, but where it came from and how to honour that, and how to use it culturally, with respect. Tyson learnt all their stories, and through these stories he learnt the lore and the seasons and the kinship and the relatedness rules for his mob. The Rangers enjoyed having Tyson around to help them manage country, and truth be told, they felt safer having their eyes on a known firebug and knowing he was growing out of being a danger to everyone. When he was ready for more practical lessons, Leon instructed Tyson in burning off sections of grass using a cool fire that could be directed and controlled. Under supervision, Tyson learnt how to burn in mosaics and how to map the proper rotations of each bit of land. His love of fire was no longer stifled or made to burn inside him with dangerous, simmering rage. He used it as a tool, applied it as a technology, and practiced it through culture. Soon he couldn't believe how careless he'd once been with such a powerful force. Jimmy and the Rangers kept in regular contact with each other. Jimmy knew his boy was being looked after, that his destructive tendencies were being curtailed and channeled into something creative rather than dangerous and wild. If only Jimmy had had such good education when he was younger. Jimmy took his responsibility seriously. He let that ranger mob know when anything was going on at home and that might affect his boy's behaviour. Tyson kept his obligations too. He stopped wagging school and put more effort in there and at home. He took more interest in his siblings, teaching them all that he learnt. Dad and Grandma listened on, rapt and proud. Jimmy's beloved Zippo even turned up one day. At school, Tyson paid more attention to his teachers, especially Mr. Mack. Tyson became more interested in science, especially chemistry and geography and the environmental sciences, as he saw the connections between his growing knowledge of the weather, climate, and seasonal cycles. He even gave a presentation for the first time in his life, having always been too shy before, but masking his shyness with a bad attitude. He did better at English, having been listening to the Rangers' stories and becoming attuned to the power and protocols of narrative for the first time. In art class, he continued to draw fire, but in patterns and processes, like the green renewal of the land. The only time Tyson used fire was under the supervision of the Rangers until one day, a few years on, they decided he was ready to begin going out on his own if he needed. Soon after, Tyson began to take his younger siblings on camp with him, and then he was helping out with their school camps too. And in this way, he grew naturally into his place in his community. And Tyson's ancestors were pleased that their knowledge was living on through their strong son, and the land was happy too, its needs fulfilled, its burning wishes listened to. Jingibala, my name's Michaela Saunders. I'm a Koori Lebanese writer, editor, teacher, Lots of other things. But as pertains to our talk today, I am the author of Always Will Be, Stories of Koori Sovereignty from the Futures of the Tweed. And it's a short story collection I wrote a few years ago now. And all of the stories are set in the community that I belong to, that I grew up in the Tweed. And all of the stories are set in a different version of the future of the Tweed. And in this book, I'm reckoning with climate change, with political scenarios, and each of the stories also asserts sovereignty in some way or another.
Michaela, what actually drew you to write this collection of short stories?
Well, we have to go back in time. So I started writing these stories in 2017 as part of my Doctor of Arts degree at the University of Sydney. Now, before that, I'd never written short story before or speculative fiction, but I was very interested in writing stories that centred blackfellas and centred us as a community rather than just kind of a lone wolf or a token blackfella in, you know, a majority white or settler story, which is a lot of the stuff I'd been reading. So before I enrolled, I'd watched a lot of science fiction, futurism, you know, Mad Max Fury Road had come out recently, and I love Mad Max, always have. But watching that film, I was really struck by the fact that in that whole franchise of four movies, there's only one Aboriginal character, and he's a ghost. He's not living. And that's a old man, he's a ghost, and he accuses Mad Max in his delirium dream. He says, "You let us die." And it struck me as the most apt metaphor for the way blackfellas are represented in the future, in the white imagination. And even sometimes in the Aboriginal imagination too, let's face it. So I started reading and thinking about all these things, and I just had this really brilliant idea to write stories where my community, my people, people I know, people I grew up with, were thriving in the future, you know, whether those futures were utopian or dystopian or whatever. So that was, you know, 2015, 2016. And so I decided I would get my stories published, but first I had to learn how to write them. So I enrolled in a creative writing doctorate degree at Sydney Uni. I hustled to get in because, as I said, I hadn't written before. I took a few workshop classes and I learnt the kind of basic mechanics, the building blocks of writing short stories from some of my wonderful teachers, and then the training wheels are off, and over the subsequent years I wrote the rest of the stories of this book.
I always think it's interesting when a book starts out with a different intention. So a book that's starting out, maybe not intention, maybe purpose is the word that I mean. The fact that this came from your studies initially and then grew into something that is much more public and much more, I guess,
non-academic?
And disconnected from that world of academia. Mm-hmm. For you, like, how did it grow?
I don't know why, but I always had utmost faith that these stories would be published. And I just kind of use that degree as a means to an end. I never intended this to just be an academic project that existed in my head or between me and a, you know, a weighty thesis that only a few people would read. I wanted these stories to be read, and I used that degree, you know, I mean, I say I used it as though that's a bad thing, but come on, you know, we use the tool of education to further ourselves. And I use that time and that space that a degree gives you to learn how to write stories and to write them well and to write them to my satisfaction so that they would be read one day.
I'm really aware that during the time of you working on this manuscript, you were, as well as doing your degree, you were also working as an editor on a collection, an anthology of speculative fiction that was particularly interested in First Nations futurism. How did working with other writers that are interested in these same kinds of thinking and same kinds of conversations inform the way that you thought about your own stories?
Well, the thing is, when you're studying, when you're doing a degree like a doctorate or some kind of research degree, it can be very solitary work. So really your friends and your community are the people you're reading, and you're having conversations with them through your own work. You're talking to them, you're having conversations with them in your mind, and it works its way into your research, your studies. So part of my reading was to track down every single example of Aboriginal Torres Strait Islander speculative fiction and read it to see what our writers were concerned with, and particularly in the future, because my stories are set in the future. I wanted to see what had been written, who had been writing it, what were they thinking about, what were their hopes and fears for the future of country and culture and community. And so through reading these texts, I came to realise that we actually have a bit of a tradition. You know, the first speculative fiction novel was published in 1990, so over 30 years ago, by the very staunch Murray activist and author Sam Watson. He wrote The Kadaitcha Sung in 1990, and that was a very weird book that, you know, hadn't been done before and people didn't know how to read it or take it. And then from then, you know, the genre started very slow, very small. But in recent years, it's really, really exploded. And to my mind, it's because climate change and climate concerns are at the forefront of our thinking, and not just as Aboriginal people, but all around the world. You know, everybody's thinking about these things. So I was reading, I was looking at the trends of who was publishing, why, what we were thinking about, and I decided that the best way to bring these conversations I'm having in my brain out is to create this, or curate, I should say, this anthology of First Nations speculative fiction. So I'd been focusing on stuff that was purely, you know, set in the future. But our speculative fiction is so much more than that. We have ghost stories, we have horror stories, we have science fiction, climate fiction. We have all these very weird and wonderful things that our people have been writing into this genre for over 30 years, as I mentioned. So the anthology, This All Come Back Now, it's an anthology of First Nations speculative fiction. It's the world first, actually. Mm. And in it, I took some of those seminal texts. So I talk about the Kadaitcha Sung. We took a chapter from that with the permission of Sam's family, because he passed away a few years ago now. Actually, his son also has a story in it, the poet Samuel Wagon Watson. That's a ghost story. We've got Ellen Van Nieuwen's, an extract of their novella Water in there. We've got Alexis Wright's first chapter of the Swan book in there. So I tried to get bits and pieces of the seminal stuff, but we've also got brand spanking new writing that's never been published before from writers who'd never published before as well. So it's a real mixed bag. But in this anthology, I wanted to show the kind of depth and breadth of our thinking in these genres and our storytelling prowess and, you know, all the weird and imaginative stuff that our people have been writing in for over 30 years.
This is a collection that you actually won the David Uniapin Award for when it was in manuscript form. Mm-hmm. I wanted to actually go back to something that you said during the conversation we had when you'd found out you won that. We talked about the role of technology in science fiction, and in particular that people get locked into the idea of what technology actually means when we're talking about speculative fiction or science fiction, and that you were really interested in kind of challenging that assumption. Specifically, you mentioned that fire is a technology, and it was something that even at the time I knew that I was going to be thinking about that for a long time. It's been literal years and I've not forgotten about it. you started by reading an excerpt of Firebug, which is one of the stories in this collection. I wonder if you could tell me a little about the thinking behind that.
It all comes from this very deep thinking and these huge questions that were brought up by all my reading of, you know, Indigenous speculative fiction, and also looking at global Indigenous speculative fiction and what our global Indigenous cousins are doing. And a very important idea of this comes from the Anishinaabe scholar Grace L. Dillon, who actually edited an anthology of Indigenous science fiction in 2012. And I read that in this period before I'd enrolled in my degree. And that was one of the books that really put the fire in my belly. I thought, oh, why can't we do that? You know, it was brilliant. And in it, she has a chapter called Indigenous Science and Sustainability. And she talks a little bit about how some of our stories that are quite out there, you know, weird, wonderful, speculative stories aren't necessarily about, yeah, robots or aliens or, you know, computers or things that go ping, ping, things that need electricity, for example. But it's more about the things that we have used culturally. And I thought about that idea very deeply in respect to our cultures. And I remember at that time I was listening to some podcasts and interviews with the wonderful cultural fire. I don't know, is he a ranger? He's an author. His name is Victor Stephenson. Mm. And he's a wonderful educator and he's so passionate. He's so much knowledge. And I was thinking about, imagine if we had people like this who took our young people out on country and they taught them this stuff from a very young age, because I worked in schools for a long time. I've worked in and out of Aboriginal education for over 20 years, and I've seen, you know, our kids go on these cultural camps and also some not so cultural camps, you know, and I've thought about what an opportunity it would be if our kids could go out with these people who have such an immense knowledge and passion for teaching about our culture, and not just for the sake of it, but for these very important reasons of continuing the teaching and education of our culture, but the health of our country and for the future. And when we're thinking about the future, who better to think about that than through the characters of children, because they're the ones who are going to inherit it. Right, so I have all these thoughts going on in my head, but particularly thinking about the way that fire is, it's used as a tool. And because it's got such an immense body of knowledge around this, it's this cultural knowledge, it's actually a technology. The way that Aboriginal people use it to burn country and use it in these certain ways, you get a sense from that, from the extract I read, that there are all these ways of using it and not using it, and proper ways and not so proper ways. And so these are all the things that I'm thinking about in these stories. I've also worked with, you know, a lot of children who, you know, they need a lot of love, they need a lot of care, they need a lot of attention. And I've seen the way our kids stand up straighter, they walk with a spring in their step when adults invest in them, you know, and especially cultural adults. I've seen the power that cultural investment has on our children. So this story is a little bit of a wish fulfillment fantasy of mine that, you know, what if our kids had the best investment that they could have, and that is the care and attention of cultural people who want the best for them, but also want the best for community and for country. The idea of science fiction is usually, you know, some new technology, something amazing. It's called a novum in technical genre terms, but it's usually thinking about some new technology and its impact on characters or society. And that's what the story comes from, right? Mm. But I wanted to think about, well, what about a technology that isn't new, but maybe it should be renewed in the way that it's widespread and taught about. So I wanted to think about a story where our cultural fire was the technology. This was the tool. This was the, you know, instead of robots or computers or holograms or lasers, we are talking about fire. It's a very fundamental technology for the health of our country and the impact of that on characters in the story. And that's really the central conceit of this as a science fiction story. I know there will be a lot of science fiction fans who would read it and they wouldn't see that in there. But for me, I'm thinking more about the logic of science fiction rather than the shiny new toys. And another thing I want to talk about is that some of the most important technology and tools we have are not electrical stuff. If we think about the way that weaving and textiles have absolutely shaped all of human history, all of human societies, Ursula K. Le Guin, the wonderful science fiction fantasy writer who passed away a few years ago, she has a wonderful essay called The Carrier Bag Theory of Fiction. And in it, she talks about how stories don't always have to be about big things that happen to big heroes, but the quiet stories that happen. And she's talking about, instead of thinking about a story as this big, dramatic, plot-driven thing, thinking about it in terms of a carrier bag, which is a humble technology, but it's been so important, and especially to our people, when you think about Coolamons and dilly bags and the importance they have for the day-to-day living. But they're not kind of lauded as these big technologies because, you know, they're just dare I say it, women's work. But this is her point, that these are the stories that really keep us going. And, yeah, I wanted to think about those ideas in this story as well.
I think what's really interesting about that is that it's drawing together an idea that is raised in Bugulba.
Bugulba, yeah.
Yeah. That's the collection's conclusion. And you wrote in that you've imagined futures, and so the cultures in these stories are just as made up as the world building. And that's, I think, right. It's making a really interesting point around, again, I think people's expectations when we are telling stories that are drawing from culture, but like that are looking to the future. These ideas aren't in opposition.
Each of these stories, so just for context, there's 17 stories in here. So there's, 16 stories, 16 different versions of the future. And some of them are in a very near to now future, and some of them are a lot more far-fetched and far-flung, you know, where the world is very different. But those nearer futures, they could be here more or less with a little tweak or two of reality. And each of the stories I wrote in a different way, and I was usually starting with different questions, right? And so to relate it back to what you've said, I don't know, I guess all this deep thinking about what a story is, what culture is, all that kind of stuff, I wanted to think about how is culture created? You know, in a very broad sense, it is the long-term exchange of the material and the immaterial between place and people over long periods of time. That's what any culture is. And it's just the stuff that naturally emerges between place and people and place, and not just, you know, place, but other creatures and energies and beliefs and all of that beautiful stuff that just comes up. And it comes out in the way we do things, the way we talk, the way we relate, all of these beautiful things. And so in these stories, I am thinking about the Tweed in a different future. So I have one story where the oceans have risen, for example. It's called Cyclone Season. In this story, I was thinking about the Tweed underwater, right? What would the country look like? You know, there would still be all those high rises, but they would be underwater. People would learn to live on the water in a creative way rather than moving inland. They would just learn to live in that way. So here we have country. How would the community live? That's another question. You know, there's an ocean bikie gang who get around on jet skis and they surf, all these kind of things. So with that, with the country there, and then you've got the community, I'm thinking about how these two interact. Then what is the culture? What is the way they do things? And this comes into effect in every one of the stories, you know, because for me as a black fella, I think we naturally think about stories in terms of not just setting, but in country. You know, what is the country of the story? Who are the people? Who are the characters? Who's the community? And how are they interacting? And so, yeah, these are the questions that I started with and how I wrote them. I thought about that. And all of the culture in these stories are made up. Of course, they're rooted in real Guri culture, you know, Tweed culture. My version anyway, how I grew up in my family, which is connected to my particular part of the community. But, you know, when you're writing the future, you have to make stuff up because it's not written yet. You know, you're imagining things. And I wanted to just be clear about that in that last note that, yeah, there's sometimes a little like, oh, is someone going to come for me if I'm writing culture where that's not my blood or it's not my place or this or that. But I just wanted to be clear that this is fiction. And when we're imagining futures, we have to imagine that stuff. It is rooted in the here and now, but it is made up. Yeah.
Before I let you go, I do want to just ask you very quickly about the Melbourne Writers Festival, because you're a guest curator this year.
Mm-hmm.
When it came to the events that you programmed,
mm-hmm.
what were your goals? What were you thinking about?
Well, I've got to say, the events that are actually happening, they weren't my first idea, but this is the beauty of working with people and curation. You know, you start with an idea, but then you talk to people, you invite them, and they have some idea, and it kind of bends and warps the direction. And this is also the beauty of working with other people. It always ends up better than you would have ever imagined, you know. So one of my events is a poetry performance. And it is three pairings of Blackfella and Palestinian poets who will be writing words of affirmation and care to each other. And for me, this is especially important because of our shared history, you know, and we have a long history, you know, going back at least to the 1970s. And for me, I'm an 80s baby. That's a long history. That's before I was born. So I wanted to celebrate that. And I also wanted to, you know, platform Palestinian writers. And the thing about the people who are in this, we've got Tony Birch, Janine Lane, Nayuka Gori. We also have Sama Sabawi, we have Sara Saleh, and we have Michaela Saeh. And all of them are not just wonderful writers and people, but they're also activists. And I wanted that political and creative spirit to be at the forefront in this program. So that's really exciting. My other event that I'm programming, I'm also interviewing my favorite writer, Alexis Wright. I think she's so wonderful. I've learned so much about her as a writer from reading her work, and she has written my favourite works, and she's got such an incredible body of work now, and I'm really excited to sit down and talk with her about her ideas and her process and, you know, the way she shapes and structures novels, because she's doing things that no one else is doing. Now she's starting to be internationally published and internationally recognised for awards, and it's just so well-deserved. And, yeah, I'm very, really looking forward to talking to her. And they're my two events, and I'm really grateful for Melbourne Writers Festival for inviting me to be part of this, because one thing I've learned over, you know, from editing my own anthology and working with other people is I do enjoy curating. It's a thing that I never had done before, but I enjoy working with other people and shaping things and you know, working towards the goal of seeing it realised. It's really lovely.
Michaela Saunders speaking with me. Their book, Always Will Be, is published by University of Queensland Press and is available now. You might like to pick up a copy and head to the Melbourne Writers Festival for Michaela to sign it. They're a guest curator of the festival this year and will also be in conversation with ABC Indigenous's editor, Daniel Browning, at the State Library on the 12th of May. Like Michaela, Daniel is from the Tweed Heads area, so it's going to be a pretty special conversation.
Find more great ABC RN stories that take you beyond the headlines on the ABC Listen app.